The Meaning of Geranium from The Secret Language of Plants by Andrina, read by Sam Gabriel, based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 21. The Night. People often think that because Gryffindors are brave, they expect everyone else to be brave too and follow them into battle. However, this is a big inaccuracy. Gryffindors don't like to fight, and they don't particularly like anyone else fighting and getting in danger's way. Are you crazy? Step back immediately. Go inside and lock the door. Gryffindors will face any kind of monster, just so the people standing behind them won't have to. They will save your life and then yell at you when you try to repay the favor in kind. This is to explain how, as six Gryffindors made their way to the Puddlemere field to borrow the professional broomsticks stored there, they were arguing all the way about how everyone else didn't need to go. So far, only Oliver, Angelina, and Alicia were winning on account of them having wands when the others did not.
"I have a hammer," tried Lee Jordan.
"You have a cooking mallet, and the head comes off when shaken, Lee.
And you almost had your hand ripped out," added Katie.
"Says the girl with the chest torn out by a harpy. It was a curse, idiot, and it's closed."
"Shut it, you,"
ordered Oliver with his best commanding voice.
"You'll only come in as lookouts when we get the brooms. You're not coming with us."
"Of course we are. I'm not letting you go alone."
Katie turned around so fast that her ponytail moved like a whip.
"I said no.
You're not the captain anymore, Ollie."
"I have a hammer.
For the last time, Lee,"
Angelina started to say. She was tired and fed up with Lee Jordan, but she was also very worried about him. He had been so pale and so weak when he collapsed on their door. Angelina had spent the night crying while they waited to see if he would survive until the morning.
"No, really, I have a hammer, look. It's all shiny and pretty."
He lifted a hand holding a shiny new hammer that still had the price tag hanging.
"I like the handle. It's a nice grip that doesn't slide."
"Yeah, I got the brooms,"
said Elizabeth, who had known Oliver before he became captain and therefore felt that she didn't have to listen to him so much or wait for him to say when to go.
"And there's also keeper gear. I'm thinking we could get the helmets and arm guards. I'm taking this bat."
"Take the balls, too,"
called Katie before anyone tried to keep her away.
"We can always throw the quiffles at them. I once got Cassius Warrington right in the face. It was glorious. Snape docked me 20 points the next day. Still worth it."
Percy couldn't even see if they were going to survive this, but if they did, he was taking a vacation. Somewhere warm and quiet where he could lay down all day and read. He wasn't even sure that he would return. Maybe he would stay there, open a bar. That was such a nice picture. Much nicer than what he had before him, the dark, dark night and the cold and all the monsters gathering before Hogwarts. Not that he was there to see any of it. It was an echo. He was still getting visions in small, quick flashes, and he thought that these were almost in real time. The wizards locking down Hogsmeade, that was about now. Hogwarts in flames, that was in 4 hours and not supposed to happen. The grounds around the castle drenched in blood, yes, would happen in 2 hours probably. A giant with pointy teeth and a necklace made of bones, now. Looking at Hogwarts with lust and gluttony. And while Percy saw all that, he rang the doorbell to Walden McNair's mansion. He would open the door himself because he had killed the last house elf and hadn't gotten around to replacing it. He would come with his wand, but he had spent the day drinking fire whiskey and entertaining two ladies, so he wouldn't have the best accuracy. The door opened, Percy threw a punch, and immediately retreated back to the street, not checking to see if he had landed it because the burn in his fist told him that he did. A punch wasn't much, but he had discovered with surprise that yoga had actually toned his muscles a little bit. In 6 hours, McNair would have an edema, and his eye would be bruised. They were so big. It was to be expected. The word said it, giants. But somehow hearing it and seeing it was much different. You heard giants, and you knew they were big, huge, but the brain couldn't really picture how big they would be. They came armed with clubs and boulders, crude weapons, but in their hands they didn't really need anything particularly technological and refined. One shuddered, thinking what they could do with a bow. It had to be said, Hogwarts wasn't a beautiful castle. The distribution of the towers was too uneven, the structure asymmetrical. The windows were sprinkled over the walls like an afterthought, and in some places there were doors opening to a big fall outside, stairs going nowhere. And in the case of the divination tower, it didn't look like it had a base at all. It simply emerged from a knot of smaller towers that were probably holding it upright. Hogwarts had nothing of the regal and clean lines of the castles that are usually available to visit, but while it looked like it had been designed by a madman, it also seemed very much like a fortress. Well over 300 windows and a dozen doors, and yet all of them seemed inaccessible. Voldemort must have known this. Most children didn't really notice how much of a stronghold Hogwarts was, too busy trying to memorize the changing pattern of the moving stairs and corridors, or too astounded by the charmed ceiling in the great hall. But the child that Voldemort used to be did, of course he did. He had also noticed how this point went unremarked and undetected by everyone else, and he fancied himself the only one who understood the castle's crazy layout. He was not. Harry had a lot to say about the lines that divided the outside and the inside of the castle. The Marauders had learned about the secret tunnels that extended away like roots, almost as if Hogwarts needed them to grow. The twins had a deep understanding of the conditions that made the stairs go one way and not another. So Voldemort was not the only one, but it was true that he was one of a few and that he knew the castle well. This is why he had sent the giants first. Rough, coarse, he did not expect them to bring him victory, but they would open a path through the forest for the other creatures, more intelligent and refined. They would also open the outer shell of the castle for him. A dozen giants, the most they had managed to get in such short notice, should be able to force the castle's doors open. They had crossed half the forest now. One of them, a female, insofar as one could guess their sex, jolted her head back. She had brown hair, very matted, that looked like the ground in a forest, a carpet of dry grass. She took her hands to her face, and when she lowered it, she discovered with surprise that there was blood, dark red, darker than a human's, in her palm. It wasn't until she blinked that she realized that there was an arrow in her eye. Nobody had heard the arrow. They didn't hear the ones that followed it either. It was as if the night took something more than vision, took hearing and the sense of smell, too. The arrows kept coming like upturned rain, swift drops that chimed over the giants. The giantess had red streaks covering her face, and after a while she tripped and fell. She tried to get up, blinded but still strong, until she dropped definitively and didn't get back up. The centaurs didn't use stones or sticks. They used bows, and they were fast and implacable. They couldn't stop the giants all by themselves, but they made sure too difficult their advancement, and they kept hounding them. 12 giants had first crossed the charms on the other side of the forest, right through the spot Roma Santa showed them, although any other would have worked. Only 8 made it all the way to the open grounds before the castle, and of those, 2 of them were blind and had to rely on the instructions of their comrades.
"All entrances are blocked and protected, Prof," said Ron Weasley.
He did not allow himself the familiarity of his older brothers, but he also wasn't using Sir anymore. A respectful professor it was for everyone, shortened to Prof depending on the mood.
"All, Mr. Weasley?" "Ronald, you know, I've been keeping you secret for years now."
"Mr. Weasley,"
repeated Severus, pronouncing every letter and a few others that usually weren't there. It put a smile on Ron's face.
"Do you think the doors will be able to withstand the assault all night?"
Ron hesitated. He might keep many secrets, but Ron wasn't a liar. The doors had been imbued with strengthening charms and barrier spells, but even those might break given time and adequate force.
"Well, eventually." "Then choose one. I will defer to yours and Professor McGonagall's good judgment. Weaken the protections in there."
"Oh, I see. If they see that a door is about to give up, they'll cluster around it. We might get a few good hits from above if we have them."
"I was thinking for when inevitably one of them cracks. We might as well pick the lesser evil and select which door is least inconvenient for us to succumb."
"Yes, we could have people waiting right on the other side. If we let one in and we kill them right away, it'll be good as blocking the door again. Maybe the main gate, then."
Tell McGonagall she will handle it. And then, Mr. Weasley, I think you should go to bed. You too, Miss Lovegood. Luna did not look like she wanted to go to bed, but since it had been her idea, she didn't fight it. She had said with that cutting clarity of hers that by the time they figured out how to lift the charm blocking humans and they got the Death Eaters inside, they were going to be exhausted from fighting all the non-human creatures, and they wouldn't be able to put up much of a fight. Hence, they had organized sleep shifts of 2.5 hours, and since they were thinking about it, she had the house elves put water bottles in nooks and crannies around the castle together with the occasional non-perishable snack. Falling asleep was going to be a hard endeavor because a dozen giants coming to your doors did not in any way facilitate a deep and restful slumber. But Snape had been talking with Professor Slughorn, saying things like 17% dilution, as if he were wishing him the death of all his relatives, so they could expect some potion help without later being too foggy for combat. Percy had a watch. After going to get the hammer and discovering that it was actually 3 hours later than what he thought, he had found some time to quickly pop back to his apartment and get a watch. It was a tradition to present every wizard on his 17th birthday with a watch. As it often happened in his family, Percy's birthday had been lost between other events. First, it was the Quidditch Championship, Quidditch World Cup, but Percy didn't pay much attention to that kind of detail. And then there was the Triwizard Tournament, and he had just started his promising career in the Ministry. Not even he had paid attention to the date. But that night, Bill came to him and gave him a small package because Bill had details like those. It was a watch, not very expensive, but more than what their parents could probably afford. Percy deduced that Charlie had also helped to buy it and maybe even picked the model. The sphere was green and the band fake dragon skin, which could be either Bill's or Charlie's choice. It wasn't very pretty, and Percy didn't want to wear it because it clashed with his formal robes. After the Quidditch Cup, he went and bought himself a different one, black and narrow and very discreet, and left the other one in a drawer. But now, when he needed a watch, this was the one he picked and put on his wrist. It was just a bit after tea, and in here it was dark and it was cold. When the clock hands were in a mirror position, it would be a bit more hot, and there would be some lights around that made the darkness all the more dark. Firebirds were breathtakingly beautiful birds. They were also very much like a deranged hippogriff on fire, meaning that they were aggressive, vicious, and on fire. Looking them in the eyes unfailingly brought to mind that quote about staring into the abyss, followed by the wish that there were some abyss to stare at, because surely the mother of darkness would be soothing compared to the firebird's gaze. Bringing them from Gibraltar to Plymouth and from there to Hogsmeade had been a miserable task that left 8 people injured with burns of varied severity, plus a wizard who had lost a finger from the left hand. The birds had not enjoyed the trip, and they were now brimming for a fight.
"We would prefer for them to cause structural damage," said Selwyn, who had been honored with overseeing the development of forces against Hogwarts for the first few hours. "But if they can also target specific people, that would be splendid."
"Sure thing, Bishop,"
said the Gibraltarian tasked with bringing the flock. He had hoped to be done once he arrived in Plymouth, kept waving a piece of parchment to be signed so he could leave, but instead he had been forced to go further north with an increasingly irritated flock. He was not prepared for this. He was certainly not dressed for this. England was cold, and all the wrong kinds of wet, and he had come wearing shorts and flip-flops because he could actually see the coast of Africa from his bedroom window, and no one had told him he would now have to stand in a muddy, cold field in the outskirts of a British town. The birds shared his frustration, which they demonstrated by picking at the bars of their cages and attempting to gouge anyone who came close to them.
"They can also sing you a Cameron song and fix the radio while we're at it."
"Am I to infer from your words that it won't be possible?"
Selwyn asked, marking his vowels to impress the point that he was much better bred than the sorry wizard before him.
"Just point them in the direction you want to fuck up,"
said the wizard, who could not care less about accents and stress and what to do with your H's.
"And when you're done, call them back with the flute."
He offered said flute so quickly that Selwyn took it instinctively, even though he hadn't intended to.
"Good luck,"
The bird screeched, something like a mix between an eagle and a derailed train. The wizards cleared the zone, and standing from the border, they watched the cages holding them. The Gibraltarian trainee had conceded to staying a bit longer and throwing some treats in the direction of the castle so the birds would go that way. Afterwards, he was going. Promise. As soon as the cages were gone, the firebirds opened their wings, long, sharp, golden in color, but somehow less reminiscent of gold and more of something hard and sharp. They had wings that looked like knives and yet impossibly managed to lift them in the air. They were above them in seconds, screeching and letting out the occasional flame. As they were going up, one of them tore a bit of the fence behind the train station and threw it against the wizards that had just freed them. They were quite intelligent, these animals, and quite vicious.
Moody, how could you? That poor innocent bird! Don't give me any of that, Tonks. That poor innocent bird just took Zonko's chimney with it.
But only after you startled it.
It was true. Moody had sent a stream of ice water to the firebird's claws, which made it take flight again, taking the mentioned chimney and breaking a piece of a neighboring roof with its wing. The bird dropped the chimney on top of a bench, flattening it, and made two tight circles before choosing another roof to perch itself upon. Selwyn and his men followed him, wands drawn, and every other pair of eyes in the village followed as well the path of the giant, crazy birds on fire. The Order of the Phoenix was free to walk from the outskirts of Hogsmeade where they had apparated, through the darkened streets and to the back door of the Hog's Head. Aberforth grunted a greeting as they came in. A bit before 8 that evening, Selwyn had arrived, cloaked and masked and very much like the definition of a Death Eater, although he had to remove the mask so they could hear him clearly. He had been accompanied by some low-level acolytes, and together they informed the Hogsmeade population that the village was closed and that they had to remain indoors and provide help when required. They had crucioed the first person to make a noise to drive the point that they were serious. Then they had taken over the train station, posting guards and checking the fenced field behind it, and they made Madame Rosmerta open the three broomsticks for them. Before anyone arrived, it already had looked like they were waiting for someone, a big number of someones. They had also cast a calling spell to warn them if anyone apparated in the village. Aberforth had seen all this, and he hadn't waited to see the giant's arrival before sending a Patronus with a message for the order. He sent it to Kingsley because Kingsley was a natural leader, and also to Moody because he was a professional survivor, and even if every other member had been murdered during the last year, he didn't know it might have happened, Moody's survival was a guarantee. He told them that the village was guarded and alarmed, and that they would have to operate outside of it. Then Aberforth took the bucket with the grain soaked in wine and spread it all over the east side of the village. The order operated in the yard of the Shrieking Shack. They had gone to shut it down the year when they thought Black and Lupin would try something at Hogwarts, so they were familiar with the place. It was a bit elevated. Not enough to give them a good view of Hogsmeade, but they could see the rooftop of the train station just on the other side of the village. They could see the glint of different spells and the movement, not the people there, not the creatures recently arrived, but they could see the movement, the turmoil that originated in the station and spread around it, as the Death Eaters organized the forces to their satisfaction. The village itself was very dark and very silent.
"We must expect an ambush," said Moody. "They'll be waiting for people trying to get in or out. Remember, our priority is getting to Hogwarts. If someone falls, we go on."
"Such brotherly sentiment," muttered Mundungus Fletcher.
Next to him, Arthur and Molly Weasley were holding hands. They had two children in Hogwarts, two children and an army standing between them.
"If something happens to him," said one of the Elderberry cousins, the scary one pointing to the other, the nice one, "and you don't stop and help, I will make you regret every day you have lived."
"That would be necessary, I'm sure," said the nice Elderberry, the one with the lisp and who didn't look like he ate snakeheads for breakfast.
Emmeline Vance said something nice before things got heated and they started to descend the small hill, keeping away from the main path. Any other night they might have been visible, a dozen adults walking in line, but there was no moon and so they were able to blend with the night. Soon almost everyone in the village would have their night vision ruined in any case. There was a shriek.
"Sounds like Grandma,"
Tonks said. and a flock of firebirds shot into the sky. The order stopped in their tracks, looking at them without breath and with their hearts in their mouths. They were painfully pretty, those birds, cruelly beautiful, and heading to Hogwarts where their talons and their wings and their fire would be as dangerous as the most nimble wizard. But they didn't go to Hogwarts. One of them shrieked again, clucked. One of them shrieked again, clucked, and descended to the village square where it began to pick at the floor, scratching with its claw and making deep grooves. The other birds followed, landing all through the street. There was absolutely no one looking their way while the order snuck in the village. They went through the dark streets without problem, and when they had to cross a wider one where they could be spotted, one simple charm to make one of the birds move was enough to have everyone looking at the sky and not at them. "They can't get inside Hogwarts," Aberforth told them, his voice a mixture of mirth and disdain. "Snape and the Carrows laid a spell to deter humans, and now their Death Eater friends can't go there to help." The clock said that it was 11, the 11th hour, but his mind told him that it was the time of bronze and gold, and somehow this made sense. Then there would be the time of white, of silver, and gray. Percy was tired, and everything was becoming a big blur. He knew what to do and what to do afterwards, but it was so much, so many variables, so many things. He was pretty sure now McGonagall would survive everything. He didn't feel like that was doing much because McGonagall was the picture of health and stubbornly clinging to life. At the moment, he was more worried by Flitwick, but he thought he had fixed that. Two centaurs were going to die or had died already. He was really sorry about that. Centaurs didn't show well in his visions. The children were going to be fine, though. Thank Merwin and Morgana and all those dead people who probably didn't really do anything to affect current events, thanks to all of them that someone had thought to send Remus, John, Lupin with the kids. He, like Kingsley Shacklebolt, was a sensible and calm man, and he would be enough to protect the odd 100 children going with him.
"The spirits have come to talk to me. Their message carried such force that it shook my rooms."
"It was a boulder, Sebel,"
McGonagall explained.
"From the giants laying siege to the castle. I didn't know if you're awake."
"I, of course, but the shock. I had a vision of a monster with red eyes and three rings of gold."
"That would be Harpo three rings,"
noted Flitwick from his position by the windows. Even though the giants by the main gate were suffering less harassment for now, a few of them insisted on attempting to break down the doors on the east side, despite the rain of curses pouring over them. They were seeing little progress for now, while the doors were holding and two more giants had succumbed either to the centaurs or to the spells from the castle's defendants. Making a giant fall was a hard task, but they were happy to say that at the moment they thought it feasible. There was a shriek followed by a whoosh, like cold water poured over a hot saucepan. Then there were screams, loud and scared and surprised, coming from the other side of the corridor. Flitwick waved at McGonagall to go, and he went back to looking down, sending something purple and sharp in the direction of a giant with only one ear. Gumpo was what Flitwick was calling him, and he hoped to give some symmetry to his face. The smell of burned hair and flesh hit Minerva as she got closer. Behind her, she could hear Trelawney retching. It was not a pleasant smell, but she couldn't spare much time in that sensation when there were three people on the floor and a big puddle of blood.
"Glacio,"
one of them was saying.
"Oh, God, oh, God."
Cho Chang was kneeling on the floor, and her legs and her left hand were covered in blood. She was attending Julius Thompson, who was seriously burned. Julius Thompson was another Ravenclaw, did well in Transfiguration, replacement chaser for the Quidditch team. The information came instantly to Minerva's mind, trivia about a boy who had been her student until last year. Now he was considered an adult, old enough to stay and fight in the first shift and get horribly burned.
"It's gonna be all right," murmured Richard Brent, Muggleborn Gryffindor, left Hogwarts 15 years ago. Not a good Quidditch player or a Transfiguration student, but he had a beautiful penmanship that was a pleasure to read. Took care of magical creatures to the Newt level.
"Julius, it's gonna be all right, you'll see."
"I'm all right, too."
He was missing his left arm. Minerva's eyes didn't deceive her. It was not a trick of the light. He was missing his left arm. Richard lifted his eyes and looked at her, a clear and clean gaze of off-green eyes. Nothing like Evans's green, Potter's green. His eyes were lighter and water-like, and in this moment absolutely serene and absent.
"Professor," he said, "it's all right, it doesn't even hurt. The fog closed the wound, so I'm not bleeding. Far's useful for that."
"Oh, Mr. Brent." She closed the distance in two strides and grabbed him in a half-hug. She still had time to glance at the open window, but it was all dark, as if nothing had come from there.
"I'll take you to the infirmary. Sybil, are you there? Then take Thompson. Chang, if you aren't hurt, see if you can close and bar the window. No, don't worry about the giants below. Just shut it closed. Come on."
She could feel the feverish heat of Brent's flesh even through both of their clothes. He was in shock, and Minerva thought she might be going into one too. Pomfrey would know. Pomfrey and her assistants, and thank all the gods that it wasn't just her, that she had spent weeks training new people, that she wasn't too proud to admit that she wasn't enough to attend to everyone.
"Susanna," said Richard Brent, as if every syllable hurt. "She's a half-blood. Brown hair, brown eyes, best smile in the world."
It wasn't long now, but it felt too long in this bloody castle with its thousand corridors. One infirmary wasn't enough.
"She's working with Madame Pomfrey. Do you think, Professor, do you think you could leave me with her? Won't get a better chance to talk to her."
Minerva wanted to cry. James Potter had once said something similar after he got in a fight. Some older boys throwing around the word mudblood. He sat in her office and accepted the lost points and merely asked through his bleeding nose whether she thought that Evans had seen him.
"You'll have to be a good patient," she told Brent. "Do everything she says." "Good advice. Good advice."
"Three firebirds isn't a flock," Severus said. True, but three firebirds have been enough to make a lot of damage and distract them from their attack to the giants. She had been keeping the spell for later, but in the end Minerva had had to animate the armors and the statues. They couldn't harm the giants too much, but they could throw stuff at them without fearing losing a limb to the birds. The firebirds could cut through stone, of course, but not as easily as through flesh. Madame Pomfrey said that Richard Brent would be all right. He wouldn't necessarily get his arm back, but he would live, and he hadn't passed out with pain, so that was a positive diagnosis. Minerva had known the fight would be hard and long. She had known people would get hurt. She had known, and still she was surprised and upset when it happened.
"Get some rest, Minerva," Severus told her. "You have done well. The armors will be enough for now."
"I can't."
"I know, but if you don't, when it is the children's turn again, there won't be any way to make them go. They won't be alone. Sirius and Sinistro will be leading them. He is smart, and she is no nonsense."
All of this made perfect sense, except for how Severus wanted her to rest and let kids 5 times younger fight in her place.
"You too?"
Her temples were pulsing with a headache, but she had lived with it ever since the first Potter came to Hogwarts.
"Severus, you too? You can't be making decisions with no sleep."
"If that's what it takes for you to rest."
They were using the library for that purpose. The Great Hall was bigger and had been used in the past for a similar end, but it was too close to the main entrance, any of the entrances, really. The library was reasonably quiet, even with the giants throwing boulders at the walls, and in there, in between the study tables, they could get a bit of rest. Minerva still hated herself for going, but she also admitted it had been a good idea when she saw the 6th and 7th years leaving. They looked, well, it wasn't what they looked like, but how they didn't look. They didn't have that pinched expression of exhaustion, that tiredness attached to the blood and the bone. They may not have slept at all, but they had been out of the fight, so now they looked calm and in control. They were untouched by fear.
"We can always open a door and fight the giants comfortably from the inside," said Sirius as they gave him the status report. "There won't be more than 2 at a time."
"Any progress?" asked Selwyn to his subordinate, a hideously ugly mountain witch that made him a bit nervous. Her work was good, you couldn't deny her that, but there was something just wrong about wizards and witches that didn't attend Hogwarts. They all received the letter, of course, and they all rejected the invitation and chose to stay at home and learn from their elders. Bunch of incestuous weirdos, if you asked Selwyn.
"The birds that arrive there are doing some damage," she told him.
Three birds, just three firebirds out of 20. The others were still playing around Hogsmeade, and that idiot trainer refused to do anything about it. He said he only had to deliver him, and that's what he did, and that Gibraltar was partly independent anyway, so he didn't have to listen to Selwyn. Once Selwyn crucioed him, he showed a better disposition to cooperate. But the truth remained that he had 17 upset firebirds to corral before sending them to Hogwarts. This is what happened when you worked with people with the wrong blood.
"Well, they seem to be working over two spots. And that's it. What else do you want? I can't use my mirror to see. The place is watered. All we have is one of your men with a pair of glass eyes. Be they cursed three times."
She spat three times quickly. Selwyn had to remind himself that this woman, Gilray, knew her way around curses and wild creatures, so she had some use even if she was afraid of binoculars. Binoculars. If the giants still hadn't managed to tear down the doors, they wouldn't do it any time soon without the Firebird's support. Officially, this shouldn't matter. Selwyn's orders had been clear and simple. 1, keep them engaged and exhaust them. 2, break down the curse, keeping humans away. That was it. So far, he was following the plan well regarding the first point. Once they had been fighting for at least 5 hours, they could start with point number 2, knowing that they wouldn't react in time to stop them. It was just, well, Selwyn had received a great honor directing the first hours of the attack. He had been surprised. He knew none of those strangers would get it because they were not in any state to direct anything other than themselves, but he had thought that Malfoy would be the one. Instead, the command had been given to him, and Selwyn wouldn't be a Slytherin if he didn't wish to have everything wrapped up by sunrise. Follow the Dark Lord's orders and go beyond them and excel, so that by the time everyone else arrived, Selwyn could lay 100 captured wands before Voldemort's feet. He was not going to get a quick victory with a bunch of dumb giants and 3 deranged birds. It was time to increase the heat and lay it hard on the people at Hogwarts. Figure of speech, of course. Heat was the last thing they were going to feel.
"I'm pretty sure the spells fall over the secret corridors. We won't be able to cross."
"Not this one," Aberforth grunted. "It exists only when it is needed."
The Hogshead was full of tension. It was no secret that Aberforth didn't like any of them, probably because they were affiliated with his brother and he didn't like Albus at all. Beyond that, many of them worked for the Ministry, and the Hogshead saw many activities that were frowned upon, or downright illegal. Perhaps, just perhaps, it also had to do with the fact that Aberforth held a profound dislike of Alastor Mad-Eye Moody. The dislike was returned with equal intensity to everyone's bewilderment, because from a distance, Aberforth and Moody were quite similar.
"Who is the girl in the picture?"
asked Motley, trying to lighten the mood. The girl smiled gently at her words before stepping out of the frame.
"My sister."
"Oh, I didn't know you had a sister. I don't think Dumbledore ever mentioned her."
Aberforth grunted in answer. Of course not, of course not. Just as they still called him Dumbledore, not him, and certainly not her. No one ever said her name, and only her beloved brother remembered her.
It's getting chilly, isn't it?"
said Emmeline Vance, the sweetest witch of the two wars. Since he was thinking about Ariana, Aberforth thought that she would have liked Emmeline. She was sweet, but also unafraid of using her wand. It was getting chilly. It was a winter night, so the statement wasn't particularly helpful or clever, but there was a sudden force sapping the heat from the room, almost as if someone had pressed a button.
"Hey,"
called Tongs in a whisper. She had turned her back to them and had her wand out. Good girl, Tongs. She once took the appearance of Albus and came to the pub and gave detention to all the Hogwarts students hanging there. Aberforth saw right through it, of course, but he enjoyed the spectacle of the squirming students.
"The windows are frosting."
The windows were frosting at a very fast rate. Kingsley was trying to peer out of them while remaining unseen. Moody simply looked around with his unblinking electric blue eye.
"Dementors," he told them.
More Dementors than I've ever seen. Soon, even with the frosted windows, they could see the dark figures moving through the street outside. It was like seeing a big sea creature swimming under the ice and wondering how thick it was after all, how long it would resist if the marine monster noticed your shadow overhead.
"Oh, dear Merlin, Ginny!"
squeaked Molly. She was once again holding Arthur's hand, and she looked about to fall down. The others were too old or too young to have children in Hogwarts, but the Weasley had two of them. Just then Ariana opened the door in the wooden wall that would take them to the castle. The presence of the Dementors was so upsetting that hardly anyone stopped to think about the deep rarity that the tunnel was. Even in a world of magic, secret tunnels didn't usually appear on a partition wall.
"Go," said Aberforth. "Everyone has the mugs, then go."
They had all walked the path between Hogwarts and Hogsmeade many times. They all knew that it took about an hour. It might take longer in the tunnel. It might not work at all if the warding spells fell over it. Molly Weasley had already darted inside, holding the mug Aberforth had given her against her bosom and with her wand out. In went the rest of them, only Kingsley and Moody staying long enough to thank Aberforth and ask him to keep them informed of the movement in Hogsmeade. They ran and ran and ran, even though the most realistic and seasoned between them knew that they would never outrun the Dementors. Hogwarts wasn't a beautiful castle. Hogwarts was an architectural aberration. Seen from above or from the forest, it did have a picturesque profile. At night, the outline of the castle, with its unnecessary large number of turrets, its roof full of gables, and easily 1,000 windows, was less threatening and more picturesque and oddly charming. It gave the impression of being big and silly and welcoming. In the evenings and in the early morning, it looked like a prison. Harry had noticed it since the first day. 8 in the morning was not a good hour to look at Hogwarts. Right now it looked as if the castle were a rocky island in a gray sea. The giants had retreated for a while, called by the sound of a horn. The 3 firebirds had also moved away to a clearing somewhere in the Forbidden Forest where someone was playing their song. Some of the roofs were smoking, long tendrils of white and black. It looked as if the castle were a rocky island in a sea at night. It looked as if a wave full of foam were coming to crash over it. The cloaks of the Dementors had a gray shine to them that, in a night like this, looked like a muted white. The year of Sirius Black, when supposedly he was coming to kill Harry, it looked like half the Dementor body of Azkaban had taken to guard Hogwarts, but honestly, that was nothing, nothing. Azkaban must have been left deserted now, and some Death Eaters had to be going around dreary places where Dementors formed to pick them up. There must be well over 100, 120 easily. They could feel their cold presence long before they began to see the pointy end of their hoods. They came from the south, from the main gate and the path to Hogsmeade, rather than from the forest. Perhaps they would have gotten tangled there in the branches, though they could float over the treetops, so perhaps not. Maybe they had come that way simply because it looked more dramatic, a big compact cloud of sorrow rising over the gate and drifting gently towards the castle.
"This is a good thing," said Luna.
Her voice was like the sun on a cloudy day, pale and unseen and covered by the gray clouds, but still powerful enough to reach their eyes with a glare. Maybe there were even more Dementors than what they had guessed at first. They were now spreading slowly to the sides in a line that was approximately the same length of the castle and 2 stories tall.
"There's so many of them. Azkaban will be empty," Luna went on. "Maybe they've left some troll guards, but the people there will feel much better, and they might even manage to escape."
And there was a strong exhalation from Sirius. 12 years, and he was now facing his worst torment in a size previously unseen.
"Sweet Merlin, Lovegood."
12 years, but also quite a lot of Gryffindor bravery keeping Sirius there, rather than stepping back and looking for another place to fight, or even locking himself in a closet. No one would judge him or hold it against him, no one. But he had stayed, and looked with them at the approaching wall of Dementors. What a horrifically beautiful image they would make. The castle hardly touched, its treasures preserved,
and the previous inhabitants wandering aimlessly through the corridors with open hands and lost gazes, until Voldemort came to claim the place. Although perhaps he would send the werewolves first, and they would fall over them, too lost and sleepy to fight back, and the picture of silver and gray would be painted in red. But that was earlier. That had been earlier in Sirius's mind. Now they had Luna's words reminding them that they were not fighting for themselves, but for the people outside. For Harry and his chances of living a life away from all this darkness. For all the people lost and captured who would be hurt instead. For Remus and the children that needed time to get away. They weren't fighting to save themselves, but to take a bad thing down. This was a very important difference. There was something almost cruel in Luna's optimism. She would not feel sad. She would not, no matter the price. She would not feel sad even when she should. She would not feel sad to the point that she would die if that would make for a generally better outcome.
"Then we better make sure that they don't return there," called Ron. "I want two wizards per window all around the third floor. Check the back two, there may be a distraction for something worse sneaking that way. And three wizards on the towers. Gryffindor, Ravenclaw, Astronomy, and Aviary. Come on!"
They jumped to action. Ron preferred to place them in layers so there would be no empty areas in the defense. If anyone fell, there would always be someone to take their place. With this distribution, however, they were spread thin all over the perimeter, but there weren't many other options nor time to argue. There was some muttering about why Ron was giving orders, which was explained on account of him being the Weasley with the highest number of freckles, which made Fred snort a surprised laugh and admit that the argument was fair enough and he would go to a tower now. The Dementors were almost over them. Below on the ground, the spells were cast less frequently, and the arrows of the centaurs were shot with more time between them. Even the giants seemed to be feeling the effect, looking a bit distracted and torpid, although it might have been the cold, that damned cold that clung to the Dementors' cloaks. First opportunity he got, Sirius was going to take a break and go put on a thick wool sweater, even if the leather jacket was way cooler. Someone was blowing a horn in the forest, and the call was like a dying wail. The Firebirds had gone, and they would have never thought that they would miss the light and the heat of those mad monsters. The giants were retreating too, and it provoked such hopelessness. "Please don't. Come back. Please don't let me die alone." When the Dementors came, you always felt so alone. They were here. They were almost over them, but this, Ron told them, was a good thing, because not everyone's Patronus could go very far. They were almost over them, but that only meant that it would be easier to hit them. They were right there. They could see the pattern in the fabric of their cloaks. The Dementors floating on top were almost right at the same level as the students on the third floor. They could see their skeletal hands with fingers that seemed to have too many knuckles. They could see that the hoods had faces underneath that looked like those of mummies. "Expecto Patronum," said Ron. That was all the signal they needed. With a wizard or witch in every window, they could see if the neighboring one had cast the spell and cast theirs in turn. And at the first flashes of silver, the wizards from the towers cast theirs too. It looked like a wave or a waterfall, like a paper fan unfolding. Ron had gone first because his Patronus was one of the most reliable. Having seen his, it was easier for the others to take a breath and conjure theirs. It looked like a silver fan, yes, but it felt like a waterfall. It was loud and strong. It was strong. It was also understood, thanks to Ron and Professor Lupin, that sometimes happiness was painful. Sometimes happiness hurt so much that it made you cry. And that only made the Patronus all the more powerful. It made them trampling, crushing, flattening. It was the feeling as the girl you loved, like a part of your body, told you that she was all right, not dead. And with those words, you felt as if you were returned a lung. It was the feeling as you saw the face of the boy you were in love with. Although you still hadn't realized it was that kind of love, you just knew that you missed him immensely, and that the thought of him passing for a pureblood and being safe in Hogwarts had been like food, giving you the energy to go on. It was the feeling as you held your idiot friend, future boyfriend and husband, in your arms, and you could swear that your heart had stopped working, but it didn't matter because you could feel him there, right there, living and breathing and hugging you back.
It was the feeling when you said no to your parents and they kicked you out of the house and the future was uncertain and scary and so liberating that it was intoxicating. When you said no to those who would see you submit just because you were a girl. It was the feeling as your insane mother, who was frail and gentle and had the most delicate wrists, looked at you as if she could recognize you. As if she weren't insane in that instant and told you that she was so proud of you and she loved you so much. And then she repeated a funny story that James had told her. James, who had been dead for 14 years. And at first she smiled and then she laughed. And this was the first time you remembered hearing her laugh, the first time. Neville had cried for hours that night, and afterwards he had stopped feeling small and clumsy and fat. It was the feeling as you heard that the girl you loved wasn't dead. That girl you loved so much that you would see her with someone else if that made her happy. She wasn't dead, just as your little sister wasn't dead, and hearing the news had been like getting a punch right to the heart. It was every little victory, every moment of sunshine stolen from the darkness, every laughter and every tear. And they fell with the force of the ocean, roaring, thundering, and devastating. And when the waters receded, when the Patronus floated away and vanished, not a single Dementor remained. Not even their cloaks, not even a little thread.
Was that a Komodo dragon? What the hell is a Patronus that's a Komodo dragon?
Oh my god, I saw that someone had an ostrich. I need that person to date me. The distance between Hogsmeade and Hogwarts took an hour to cross. The Order did it in half that time, and they arrived winded, sweaty, and covered in mud and dust, with the exception of the Slytherin Elderberry, who was impeccable. Some strands of her hair had gotten loose, and she was fixing them as if this were the biggest tragedy that could happen tonight. They emerged from the fifth floor to a castle that wasn't as noisy as usual during the school year. But there was noise and movement and an underlying tension, meaning that the Dementors weren't there. They took a collective breath. They had arrived in time.
Oh dear, how did you come in? No human is supposed to come in, never mind, stay here. I will warn the headmaster right away. Hate to cut his rest shifts short, but he must know about this.
They barely got any time to see the feathers of nearly headless Nick's hat before he disappeared through a wall. The witch said that it was 1 a.m. Technically, they were in the day of the Battle of Hogwarts now. They would mark the date of the day in which Voldemort entered Hogwarts, not the day when the attack itself started. Percy still had with him a plastic bag with 2 or 3 dozens of iron nails. He also had an apple, a bit old and wrinkly, but it may be that it was the first thing he had eaten since Wednesday. If he had eaten breakfast on Wednesday, he couldn't remember. It was a very good apple, that was the point. On the floor, the hag stirred, and Percy whacked her again on the head. Not the most powerful witch of the country, nor even the mountains in which she lived. She was just a hag, nasty and wild. Like the one currently helping Selwyn, only this one was even less powerful. But she was lucky, even if she didn't feel so at the moment. She was lucky, and she knew how to brew a potion that emitted a debilitating smoke, something that at the first drift would make people drop dead. It was hardly the best weapon to invade a castle. It couldn't be thrown, just deposited on the floor so no one would go through there. It was actually quite stupid, and Percy had had it up to here with stupid people. As soon as the potion was discovered, someone with good aim would vanish the whole thing from a safe distance. But it would be discovered by Luna Lovegood, or rather when someone saw her dead body lying on the floor, the hag trying to drag it without getting too close to the fumes. She wanted to eat her spleen and make a necklace with the bones of her fingers. Percy's visions were so good that he got to see the damned necklace worn by someone else. The hag had been killed, in a future in which they all had lost and kept losing for many years. Percy didn't know Luna very well, or at all, but she had been really good to Ginny after that terrible first year in Hogwarts. Ginny had bought her a funny pair of earrings for Christmas, that's why Percy remembered her. He didn't need to hit the hag on the head a third time, but he did it anyway. For the necklace.
Oh, oh, oh!
Exclaimed Sirius excitedly as soon as he turned the corner. Remus said that when they were young, he had been prone to bouts of deep depression in between the cheer that bordered on mania. James had been the one with a constantly joyful character. But ever since Azkaban, Sirius had been steadily cheery, and he didn't dwell for too long in glum. Severus found that he was glad.
Can I please? Before any of us die, just let me please.
Go ahead, said Sirius, who had come with him to check on the most certainly friendly intruders that Nick had told them about. He still had almost an hour before he was due to get up, but he hadn't really gotten much sleep, merely a power nap and the opportunity to do a crossword. The time to distract the mind was good, though. It helped to sharpen his senses and get his ideas straight. Sirius beamed at him.
He isn't a servant of Voldemort,
Sirius said with a big smile, pointing at Severus, who just stood there being thin and dressed in black and the epitome of a cartoon villain.
No! Independent party! Because old Dumbles made some very questionable choices, including letting me rot in Azkaban for 12 years, and here comes the best. I'm not done yet, Moody. Listen, you mad old fart, listen. Is this all necessary?
Alistair Moody started to say. Kingsley put a hand on his arm and shook his head. He had experience with Black and his friends. It was too late to try to curtail him.
My friend Snappy here is the one who got Harry from that abusive hole where he was living, not Remus. Boom!
Every single member of the Order of the Phoenix turned to stare at Snape. It was hard to say whether they were more shocked by this piece of information or by Sirius referring to him as a friend.
If you are quite finished, Severus said in a mellow tone, I do have a battle to win. Yes, Miss Tonks?
Tonks had raised her hand, much to Moody's annoyance. She had a cute pixie cut and deep pink hair. Not what is usually referred to as bubblegum pink, not that soft pale tone, but rather bubblegum wrapping. It was loud and harsh and quite a sight after the Dementor attack.
Are you also Galahad? The girl asked.
No.
Is it serious?
There is no one in this castle going by that name. Now, if you would be so kind as to help us with the forces intent on massacring us.
Oh boy, I'm the best informed wizard in all of England, Sirius said to himself while they showed the newly arrived reinforcements how they were organized.
Oh, more adults. Whatever will we do without them?
It was agreed in the Slytherin common room that Theodore Knott Jr. was a treasure to be cherished and esteemed. With his usual lack of tact, Mundungus Fletcher was about to remind everyone that Theo's father was most likely outside, waiting to fight them and kill them all. A Death Eater's son shouldn't exhibit such sarcasm. However, the scary elderberry kicked him in the ankle before he got more than 2 words out. She had come wearing a pair of expensive heels, a mixture of black and green that sparkled in the light. As a concession to the situation, she had foregone her usual pencil skirt for a pair of black trousers that emphasized the length of her legs.
"Did anyone call the Weasley kids?" said Severus while he overlooked the latest report from the infirmary.
Sirius had left the professor's common room to go check things in the front line. It boiled down to a few injured, none fatal, and a prayer of thanks that they had thought of brewing potions beforehand and training people. Pomfrey refused to set a second camp like McGonagall had requested because of reasons that sounded sensible enough that Severus felt comfortable skipping over them. She said she was using the house elves to apparate the injured to her, and while this jolted them and a few had fainted, it guaranteed that they got treatment quicker.
"Theo, quit the sass and go call Weasley," Snape ordered. "Take his place, but Till, no, the other one. We have got a bit of a breathing room now, but the ghosts tell me the giants are coming back soon. Go see about mending some of the stone damage. Professor Flitwick will be there soon if you need help. Why are you all carrying mugs?"
It took them a while to realize he was now speaking to them. Severus was a man known by the care with which he enunciated his words, and he had spoken as fast as Sirius Black. Kingsley was the first to recuperate because he was a man who had his prefect tenure with the Marauders. If that wasn't training for his later career as an Auro, nothing would be. He had excellent reflexes.
"Wheat and wine," he said, lifting the mug. "For the firebirds."
"Wonderful,"
Severus said with the same intonation with which he might say fish sticks.
"Take care of that, then."
He put the papers down and picked up others. These ones were pink and had daisies drawn in the corner, which meant, although of course they had no way to know, that it was Lovegood telling him about the newly rearranged rest schedule updated to account for the injured.
"Oh, and Mr. and Mrs. Weasley might want to stay. I'm sure they would like to see their children."
The inept Gibraltarian had finally gotten the birds back, and this time they had chained them and dragged them through the muddy path all the way to the gates of Hogwarts, where they would be released. The giants were back at it, and it seemed like they were making some progress with the main door, so if things kept going like now, in an hour Selwyn could have 2 packs of werewolves inside the castle.
He had been promised vampires too, but they were still on the train, or so Gilray had told him. Not too bad. He might still get his victory before sunrise, even if he had inexplicably lost the Dementors. He had to get the wards down at the very least, or Voldemort would punish him hard for such a loss. 200 Dementors gone, how could he have expected that? The birds were bristling and lashing at each other. He had to open his coat because the heat near them was unbearable, and the Gibraltarian, he had a name that Selwyn did not care to memorize, grunted with effort. He had finally stopped with the sass, or speaking altogether. He was sweating and bleeding from various cuts from the bird's wings.
Go!
The Gibraltarian vanished the chains, and the birds immediately took to flight. They rose over the trees and the gate and went naturally towards Hogwarts. That's where all the lights and the sounds were.
Oh, Ginny, Ginny! Mum! Oh, my dear, oh, dearest, Ginny, Ginny, my little girl!
The rest of Mrs. Weasley's words were lost in Ginny's hair, and she held her daughter close. Her girl, her sweet little girl. She had had to go before Ginny returned from Hogwarts, and there was not a day in which she hadn't wished she had stayed for her. They had gotten word that Bill had taken them for the summer, but Bill was Bill, and although Molly had no doubts that he would protect them, he still kept his long hair and an earring, and he just wasn't good enough to care for them, not like she would. That French girl would be no good either. She might try to feed them snails. But it didn't matter. Ginny was here, she was fine. She had been in Hogwarts under Snape, and she was fine.
Oh, Ginny, I love you so much, my dear.
Oh, well, good to know who's the favorite child of the family, don't you think, Fred?
Right you are, George. Always thought it was Bill.
Mrs. Weasley emitted a short shriek, and she ran to hug her twin sons. She did not release Ginny first, and so she knocked their heads together. There were some ouches and more unintelligible screaming, and then Arthur Weasley was before his sons with his eyes full of tears, which was something incredibly uncomfortable to witness. Molly was supposed to be the emotional one. Arthur was agreeable and absent-minded, and it was just wrong to see him crying. Ron stayed behind, waiting patiently, because he might not know who the favorite child was, if there was any. But he knew who the forgotten one was. It was all right. It might have hurt earlier in life, but now he was too busy to be upset about it. He had just successfully led his first charge into battle. And he still had a bit under 1 hour to work, no matter what Snape was doing up now. He had plans for the Giants and was already thinking 3 or 4 moves ahead. If his parents were hugging his other brothers first, it really didn't matter. Arthur Weasley lifted his head from Fred's shoulder and he blinked at Ron. It took him 2 seconds to recognize his youngest son, who was now taller than the twins and, more than that, looked older. Looked like a man. Ron's blue gaze was calm and mature, and he was looking at Arthur not like a son looks at his father, but like an equal. One of the main officers in the Battle of Hogwarts. But he was still a 17-year-old boy, around 3 months until he was 18. So when his father came to him with his lips trembling, Ron took his hug and he loved it. The wine-soaked grain had been dumped and spread over the ground of one of the inner cloisters. The Weasleys had given theirs to others because they were not done hugging their children. For some reason, a Slytherin girl, one that might have been active during the riots, they weren't sure, was now there and looking at the scary elderberry with cow eyes. They could see the stars from where they were, and the reflection of spells on the side of one of the towers, the aviary it looked like, but still it seemed like the place was too enclosed and too deep to be found by the firebirds when they had a whole castle full of people sticking their arms and heads out. There were 20 birds, and they only needed one of them to see the grain. The others would follow even if the first firebird tried to keep it secret. It was their favorite thing in the world. There was a screech,
"I tell you, just like Grandma are the memories."
And then a firebird came flying and took one piece of gutter with its razor-sharp wing. There was no need to order them to empty the cloister as the birds descended upon them.
"Well, I think they're just beautiful," Tonks informed them, her hair turning up and spiky and going golden.
She did not quite get the look, but the color was pretty good. More birds followed. Soon all the walls leading down to the cloister were full of deep scratches and missing every ornamental piece. Some of the most intrepid birds were sticking their heads between the columns of the cloister in case there was more wheat or something equally interesting over there. The order stayed behind, on the shadows and on the windows facing there, carefully counting the birds. It wasn't easy. One firebird was identical to another and they kept moving. Daedalus Diggle stuck his head out from one of the top windows.
No more birds in the sky, he said. It must be all of them. Unfortunately, this meant that the 20 birds all turned to look at him, and their previous behavior indicated they would now try to rip Daedalus's head off. The ones looking through the columns immediately backed up, and the others started to open their wings, although there were so many of them that it wasn't easy for any of them to actually take flight. This was quite positive. It gave Daedalus enough time to also stick out his arm and wand, and then everyone casted a protective spell at the same time. A silvery net formed in the air and carefully descended, trapping the birds onto the first floor. Would it be enough to keep them there? They had no idea. Firebirds weren't studied in Hogwarts beyond a one-page mention for obvious reasons, given that they lived in warmer climates. They might be able to burn so hot that they would melt the stones around them, but they still had to try to keep them there. For now, everyone retreated quickly, because what everyone knew through recent observation, if not study, was that humans' presence irritated them. They even hung black velvet curtains over the windows so they wouldn't see any lights or movements through them. There was still some shifting between the birds, a wave of irritation and confusion that is seen in coops everywhere, and then they seemed to settle more or less comfortably and went back to picking at the ground. It wouldn't last. It might not last. Any hit from the giants, any curse cast too loud, and they would be back to thrashing and burning, and no one was confident that the charm or the walls would hold. Fortunately, Hogwarts had someone insane enough to look at a flock of 20 giant birds on fire and think that they probably just needed some treats and being pet behind the ears. Someone who attempted to keep a dragon in a wooden hut, who raised a giant murderous spider, who to this day thought hippogriffs were sweet creatures if one knew how to treat them, and who refused to accept the blasted scroots for the unholy monstrosities that they were.
"No pushing, no pushing," said Hagrid
as he stepped into the cloister with a bucket full of freshly prepared grain with wine.
"Hey, don't peck at your brother, you. There's enough for everybody."
Selwyn couldn't help smiling and leaning back with satisfaction when at last they saw the giants break the damned door. There. Once a line was broken, it remained so, and he could see through the magic binoculars that Urduk, the chieftain of the giants, was crossing the threshold and coming into the entrance hall of Hogwarts. Later he would have to be killed for sullying a sacred wizarding place with his presence, but for now he was going inside. And tripping, it seemed. He was tripping, that bloody stupid oaf. And falling, and... he was not getting up. The view was now obscured by two other giants who rested their weapons against the wall and each took a leg to drag Urduk out. There seemed to be some resistance.
"My lord," said Gilray.
There was a cloud of an acrid smell around her like rotten garlic and a dead animal.
"My cousins can help you. They're here. They only wait for you to give the order."
Yes, but it filled Selwyn's mouth with distaste. He didn't like them. But he didn't like the giants either, and they weren't going to go much further. Plus, all the freaking firebirds had disappeared behind a tower, and they were supposed to be the most fearsome fire creature short of the dragon.
"They are intelligent, sir. They can follow the most complex orders."
So they might actually get inside and kill Snape and break the bloody charms keeping them out.
"They are hungry. All they ask is that they be allowed to feed,"
Gilray added in a raspy whisper. Then she coughed.
"Heart. Liver."
Selwyn lowered the binoculars and looked at the line of the castle and the trees.
"Very well."
End of chapter 21. For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 and Tumblr pages of Endrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information found on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. There you can also find all the other stories that I've read, as well as links to my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.